ladies and gentlemen. Welcome, wrestling fans worldwide, to Knoxville and the Great Smoky Mountains for the Ron Fuller Tennessee Studcast.
6 feet 9 inches tall, 265 pounds.
This historic podcast from one of the most respected and successful wrestlers and promoters will follow the footsteps of one of the largest and oldest wrestling families on the planet.
The Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller.
Through 93 years and four generations.
The Stud has arrived.
Old school or new fan, this unique broadcast will educate and captivate as Ron details decades of professional wrestling's growth with truly unforgettable stories.
I want those people out there at home to hear the Stud.
Sit back and enjoy the ride with the Tennessee Stud.
The Tennessee Stud. You will learn that name. You will remember it.
And now,
the Stud is here.
Please welcome the creator of the popular 605 podcast and the president of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network, your co-host, the great Ryan Last.
Hello again, friends, and welcome to another edition of Ron Fuller's Studcast. I am the great Ryan Last, and I'm very happy to be with you once again as the Tennessee Stud takes us down the road of wrestling history. And without any further ado, here he is, the man himself, the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller. Ron, this is an exciting episode today because we're kind of getting into that Tennessee Stud time machine. We're going a little bit past where we've been talking about. We're going to go to early 1974, and I'm really looking forward to this episode.
Yeah, so am I. We're going to talk today about one of the most popular and admired and revered. I mean, there's not enough adjectives for him. In his personality, and certainly not for his size. We're going to talk Andre the Giant today. And I love this guy. I just, and this is my first time laying eyes on Andre. We're going to start there with this one. We're probably not going to get back to Andre for a considerable length of time in the chronology that we're doing on my family. But I wanted to jump ahead a little bit and just throw in a little Andre because I just love the guy so much. And I know the fans out there around the world think a great deal, maybe as much or more about Andre than probably any wrestler that maybe ever lived.
He's certainly been on a lot of people's minds just recently. The WWE has an Andre the Giant Memorial Battle Royal each year at WrestleMania. And of course, HBO just recently released an Andre the Giant documentary that received a lot of attention. But we're going to talk about your experiences with Andre. And of course, patrons of the Studcast who go to either tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast have already heard you for over 3 hours talk about Andre the Giant. But we're going to give everyone a little bit of a taste of your personal Andre the Giant experience here this week.
Yeah, I really look forward to it. I love the guy. And let's just jump right into it, Brian. Andre, now I'm going to give a little background for Andre. I'm sure fans around the world have heard all types of different information about Andre. Some of this comes personally from what Andre told me, and some of it I've not seen in any type of programs that's done about him or specials on him or anything else, which that's wonderful for me because I feel like that Andre confided in me and told me things that maybe he had not told to a lot of other people. And so we'll just start off with his name. For fans that don't know, his real name is Andre Rene Rusumoff. He was born in 1946 in Moline. I don't know exactly how to pronounce this city. I think it's probably Moline, France. And I obviously died in January 1993 in Paris of heart failure in a hotel room. Pretty sad way to go. Andre spent a lot of his life in hotel rooms, but at least he was close to home. And I think he had visited home because his father had died. And I'm not absolutely father or mother. I know that he was in France to see his family, and it was for a sad occasion. And he ends up dying in Paris. I assume it was afterward, and he's basically about to be on his way home. Andre, it was a huge, huge individual. Everybody that's ever seen Andre, it's just, he's remarkable. You don't forget Andre. And he suffered from gigantism. It's a strange disease that obviously not many people have it. And his size was just huge from kind of the very beginning. At 12 years old, he was 6'3", and he weighed over 200 pounds at 12 years old. He was 7 foot something. Now, you know, people, they've always said to me, you know, well, Ron, I've seen pictures of you and Andre, and you're right up there close with Andre, but Andre was taller than I was, and there was no doubt that. I'm a good 6'9". Andre had to be 7 feet something. Now, I don't know whether 7 feet two, 7 feet four. A lot of people have said that he was 7 feet 4 inches tall, and that certainly could have been. When he had his afro, he looked taller than that. When he had his hair really big, as he did in the beginning, the first few times that I saw him, then he really looked like that 7 foot four easily. I say, you know, people say, well, how much do you weigh? And I said, always over 500. I don't hardly ever remember Andre ever telling me, or I never saw him at a weight less than probably 500 pounds. And he loved to drink. That's everybody knows that. And that I would probably get to at another time. We'll converse and talk about that. I've got great stories about that, too. And those that listen to the Super Studcast will probably be aware of how much I've witnessed him being able to drink. But one of the things that fans may not be aware of, Andre was born in a small town, and he obviously grew to be very large. So, and he didn't go to school through all of the school. He wasn't able to finish high school. He went to work. He did whatever. Actually, I think he started wrestling pretty young in life. But he was married. He was living next to a neighbor who is a very renowned individual himself, Samuel Beckett, who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1969, was a neighbor of Andre's. And I asked Andre, you know, I'd heard that Samuel Beckett, that name, and I said, tell me something about Samuel Beckett. And he told me one time, he said, Samuel used to take him, Andre had grown so large at an early age that he couldn't get on the school bus and the seats didn't fit him well. And he had trouble, obviously, getting into them and getting off the school buses. And I think the school buses in France are probably a smaller version. As we live in the United States, we're accustomed to everything's pretty big here. And when you go to other countries, you find out buses and things like that aren't near as big, planes, everything you deal with. So Andre gets in this situation where he's having trouble getting on and off the school bus. And Samuel Beckett is a friend of the family. And Samuel starts taking Andre to school, and he picks him up from school to get him home. He's got a convertible. And I don't know what kind of convertible it was, but Andre said he had a car that had no top. And he would sit him in that car, and he said they'd talk about all kinds of different things, cricket and soccer and things that are big in Europe that aren't so big in our country. But he said they had a great relationship, him and Samuel Beckett. I was really taken by the fact that two of these tremendously famous people are going to be living in one of a small little French town. It's just pretty amazing to me. And being neighbors and close to one another, as history goes by, people, that's remarkable to me. What a coincidence that something like that happens. And another story Andre told me, I asked Andre one time, I said, does anybody else in your family have your gigantism, that what you're dealing with? And I said, basically, I said, are you the biggest person in your family? And he said, no, Ron. He gave me the Andre voice, and no, Ron. He goes, my granddad was much bigger. And I was like, whoa, You know, I was like, it threw me, you know, for a loop. I was like, I said, no, Andre, your kidney, he's not much bigger. And he goes, oh, yes, Ron. He said, you know, he was 7'8" and almost 8 feet. And he weighed between 600 and 800 pounds. And I was like, gosh. Oh, buddy, I'm looking at Andre and trying to imagine anybody being larger than him. But, you know, and then lots of these types of deals where you inherit something or you get something like what Andre had that caused him to die at an earlier age and made his life very difficult for him. It's handed down sometimes, and it's usually that skip generation. So that made sense to me. It's that grandfather he had that's two generations above. And maybe Andre has children. It could be two generations after him that you would see that same type of thing again. But I was really pleased that, you know, that he confided in me and told me things that I don't know if he'd ever told anybody about his grandfather. I've never seen anything about his grandfather being with the same condition and being much larger than Andre. So it really made me feel good to have the type of relationship with Andre. He'd feel comfortable to tell me most anything I ever asked him. And we spent a lot of time together. I really want to talk today about the first time I ever saw Andre, the first match, the first night that he actually wrestled. And actually, he had wrestled in West Palm the night before. But in Tampa, second night, he comes to Florida, and I think it's April of 1974. And he's just, he rocks the world for everybody. And I'm in a Tampa dressing room, and I saw him the night before because I'm on the West Palm card. But when I get to Tampa, some of these guys were in Orlando, and they haven't seen him. So it's me and these younger guys. It's like Slater and Mike Graham and Roy Lee Welch and Jackie Welch, Lester's two sons. They're probably not on that card in Tampa, but they're in the dressing room, and they don't know. When you wrestle, a lot of times you forget who you're wrestling. Even when you do interviews, you do maybe interviews for six towns. You don't remember who you're wrestling each individual night. And a lot of people come, they don't remember who they're wrestling. So they don't know what the card is for the night. And I remember that Andre shows up in the dressing room. And the first thing that happens is he opens the dressing room door in Tampa. Now that's in the Fort Homer Hesterly Armory. It's an old armory. It's a big old armory. It's designed interior for great crowds for wrestling or boxing event, because that's what predominantly happens in this armory in Tampa. And Andre, the door opens and Andre blocks out the light. I'm kind of making a joke out of it, but it's really true. I mean, he steps into the door and we're sitting in the dressing room, and everybody, there's a little conversation going on. Everybody's, you know, enjoying themselves and talking back and forth. And when he opens the door and the light goes away, everybody just goes silent. And when he bends down, he's got the big afro at that point. He bends forward and he turns his body sideways because his shoulders are wider than the door. And his head, obviously, is too high to come underneath the door. So he turns sideways and kind of diagonally moves his body into the room and then stands up. And, wow, I mean, I'd seen him the night before, but I look around. I want to see expressions. And, oh, I'm telling you, every jaw drops. It's like, whoa, my God, who is that? You know, they don't know Andre. They don't know. They don't remember it's a battle royal. They've never seen him before. And Frank Balois comes in with him. Now, before I go on into Andre, I want to talk just briefly about Frank Balois, because Frank is an unusual character, too. He's from Montreal. He's not only a wrestler, he's a promoter. And he speaks fluent French, so he's perfect interpreter for for Andre. And I couldn't figure out why they picked Frank to be with Andre, but it turns out that when Andre starts wrestling in Paris, Frank comes into the picture somehow, and Andre's earlier years, and maybe from almost the very beginning, and he trains Andre. He's the guy that trains Andre, and once he trains him, he becomes his business manager. For the first 5 years, I think, that Andre's in wrestling, he's pretty much handled by Frank Valois. And Frank is he goes with Andre everywhere for those first few years that Andre's in America, for sure. He goes with him everywhere, really. He goes with him to Japan and Australia and Mexico. And Andre works a whole lot of other countries before he gets to America. He's in Canada. And Valois speaking French, Valois coming from Canada. Andre has a great deal of comfort, and he really trusts Frank Valois. And Frank, obviously, is going to stay with him because Andre speaks very little English at this point in 1974. He cannot say much in the English language to you, and it makes it very difficult for him. And he needs Frank, and Frank is a great guy. I am going to actually wrestle Frank Valois in Madison Square Garden in New York City in October of 1973. I've already seen Frank. You know, I know who Frank is because I've wrestled him before I meet Andre. So Frank, I recognize, and Frank comes in behind him. I'm like, geez, I'm trying to figure out why is Frank with him? And then Andre sits down, and everybody in the dressing room is normally it's kind of a customary in a wrestling dressing room that you introduce yourself. If someone doesn't come to you, you go to them and you shake hands and you introduce yourself. It's just part of wrestling etiquette, let's call it. And so that process starts slowly with Andre. And I say slowly because the guys don't jump up and want to run right over there and meet this huge son of a gun. They're kind of, and yeah, I noticed guys kind of pairing off, and there was a lot of whispered conversations, and I was getting some of it from Slater and some of it from Mike, and they were like, wow, geez, Ronke, what are we going to do with this guy in the Battle Royal? What's he going to do to us? You know, I was like, so it was a strange atmosphere to begin with, and it really caused a totally different sensation in the dressing room than I ever saw before that or after that. He just really rocked everybody's world. When they see him go to the ring later on, he's going to rock the world for all the fans too, and that's what made him what he was as time went on.
A couple questions for you about things that you went over about Andre. But first, I want to ask you, you said that when he was 12 years old, he was 6'3" and over 200 pounds. For comparison's sake, you grew to be 6'9". When you were 12 years old, how tall were you and how much did you weigh?
Oh, gosh. I can remember being in the eighth grade. And that is, what is that? I got to figure that out in years. That's 14?
12, 13, 14, one of those years, yeah.
About 14, so about 14 years old. I wasn't any taller than anybody else. I had these big growth spurts starting when I was a freshman in high school, and I grew 4 inches and 5 inches and 4 inches and yearly rate after that for 4 years, 5 years almost, I probably grew more than a foot, 14 inches or so. So I didn't have that great. He must have had this great growth rate from practically the beginning. So I was pretty much a normal height. I was probably, I'm going to say 5'7", maybe at 13, 14 years old, and probably weighed maybe only 140 pounds. You know, nowhere near the size that strikes me, that 6'3" and 200 pounds at 12 years old. I've got a grandson that's a big boy. He is 5'8" and he weighs 155 pounds. He's 11 years old. Now, you know, and he's going to be a monster. He's going to be, he'll be the biggest Welch in history, undoubtedly. And hope someday I can train him and put him in the ring. You know, this that's massive. For a 12-year-old, that is a big, big 12-year-old.
Andre, of course, arrived in North America a few years before that. He had been a sensation at the box office in Montreal. He had wrestled for Vern. He had wrestled for the Bruiser. Vince McMahon got a hold of him, made him Andre the Giant. I think Bruiser gave him the name. And he actually was on that show you wrestled at Madison Square Garden in October of 73. Would that have been the first time you had seen Andre? He had only just arrived in America a few months before that.
That's crazy, because I don't really remember Andre. And maybe the reason I don't really remember Andre is he might have been in a different dressing room. Gardens was, you know, it's a big, huge building. And I went to the Gardens. This is going to sound strange to you, Brian, but I happened to have a guy that was on the main event that night, and it wasn't a battle royal. I don't remember. I know I wasn't in a battle royal with him that night.
No.
I was there basically to sit next to and to get back related again to a guy that spent a lot of time training me, not only to wrestle, but to play basketball, to play football. One of the greatest athletes I ever saw in wrestling, Joe Scarpa, Jay Strongbow. Jay Strongbow was on the main event that night, and I really, of all the people in that dressing room, I wanted to sit with Joe, because I hadn't seen him since 1966. This is 7 years later. I was just a big kid. Now I'm becoming a pretty big star in my own right. And I was looking forward to seeing Joe Scarpa. And Andre probably was not in my dressing room. And that's probably why I didn't see him. And I did not see the whole card that night. I left even before Joe wrestled and had his match. I left the arena. So Andre probably was later in the night. To wrestle in Madison Square Garden is just a phenomenal, phenomenal opportunity. I mean, when you get invited, and Vince Sr. invited me, I was doing pretty good. I was becoming a pretty good star in Florida at that point. And Florida's TV was in New York, and Vince called me up and asked me, "Ron, would you like to work in Madison Square Garden?" And who says no to that?
And of course, you're also becoming a star in St. Louis at the same time. Just so we let the listeners know, the three big matches this night that we're talking about, October 15th, 1973, Madison Square Garden, New York City. The three big matches, Andre the Giant defeated Blackjack Lanza, Chief J. Strongbow went to a 20-minute draw with Don Leo Jonathan, and Pedro Morales defeated Stan Stasiak to retain the world title. Stasiak would, of course, go on to defeat Pedro a couple years later.
Great card. I should have stayed. You know, when you read that card to me, I'm like, what the hell am I doing leaving, man? I'm a young guy. I'm working in St. Louis quite a bit during this time frame. I'm in with the big boys. I mean, when you're wrestling in St. Louis and you're wrestling in the Garden and you're wrestling in some of these arenas, you have the opportunity to see the best wrestle, and you get to wrestle the best too at the same time. And Frank Valois himself was no slouch. He was pretty darn good, and he's up in age at this point, but we have a great match in the Garden, and I was really surprised. I got a great hand from the fans because Florida wrestling was there, and it was getting over. We digress here a little bit. Let's kind of get back a little bit to Andre, because when I went to introduce myself to Andre, it kind of finally became my turn, and I go over and I shake his hand, and that's an experience. When you shake the Giant's hand, you never feel so small as when you're around that guy. He made you feel tiny. I try to shake hands with him. Well, I do shake hands with him, but I can't reach across his palm. His hand is so big that my hand can't reach across his entire palm. My hand felt like a baby in his hands. I was like, wow, geez, this is a strange feeling, you know. He can't speak much English. You know, he's nodding his head, and Frank is doing the talking for me, basically. And I'm talking to Frank because I realize, you know, Andre's not got much English capacity at this point to speak the language. So I asked Frank, I started asking Frank a few questions about him. And, you know, and I say, I look down at his feet and he's like, wow, you know, I mean, it's just, he got that body. You got to have foundation. And by gosh, he has a foundation too. So I says to Frank, you know, how what size shoes did he wear? And he says, he wears a 22E. And I say, my first thought was, where does he buy those suckers? Where do you go buy a 22E, right? I mean, so he's got to have his clothes made, you know. And then I say, you know, geez, and I'm kind of looking at his hand, and I say to Frank, I say, gosh, he's got huge fingers, and his fingers were awesome. They were just they were just monstrous. And the thickness of them, not so much the length. Of course, there's long, too, but they're this very, very thick. And so Frank must have got this a whole lot because he reaches in his pocket and he brings out a silver dollar. And he asks Andre in French to remove his ring. Andre's got a ring on his ring finger. He takes his ring off and Frank takes the silver dollar and he passes it through the ring. I'm like, whoa, dog. He needed to say nothing. He didn't say anything. He just took the, he asked him for the ring, took the ring. He took the silver dollar. He passed it through there and gave it back to Andre. Gosh, nothing could have explained the size of his finger better than that.
We will return to Tampa and the over-the-top rope battle royal main event on Andre's introduction to Florida in a moment. But first, we want to give you a taste of the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 6, Japan 1983.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you're traveling with Intertrans in Phoenix, Arizona, flight number 540, please report to D-11-3 around the corner.
In 1983, a young Tennessee stud, Ron Fuller, boards a flight at Tampa International Airport and begins an epic journey. After a flight change in Atlanta, it's on to Los Angeles, Hawaii, and then it's wheels up on a final flight over the Pacific. Stand in the shadow of Mount Fuji, like stepping into an oil painting, engulfed with the smell of wisteria, walking among sacred temples, a golden pavilion, the imperial palace, and the bamboo forest of Kyoto. This is the land of the rising sun. This is Japan, 1983. Now, on Super Studcast number 6, the stud meets up with a young Barry Windham to hit 16 Japanese cities in 17 days for the biggest tag team wrestling tournament in the world. And he brings back to life the Funks, Bruiser Brody, Stan Hansen, Dos and Mil Mascaros from Mexico, and 7'4" Giant Baba, plus numerous Japanese wrestling stars and 1983's world champion, the Nature Boy Ric Flair. It's time to experience another world from the eyes of one of America's greatest storytellers. This is what Super Studcast are all about. And this is how Ron Fuller is changing podcasting forever. Now, let's get the rest of the story from Japan 1983 with your questions answered by the Tennessee stud Ron Fuller. Now, please welcome your host, Brian Last.
Example of what you can hear on the latest Super Studcast, Super Studcast number 6, Japan 1983. It's really an amazing episode, one of my favorite ones that we've done, You can hear Ron talk about working with Bruiser Brody, Stan Hansen, Barry Windham, the Funks, and some hijinks the likes of which we have never had on the Studcast before. Check that out at tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Only $2.99 for a two-hour spectacular. And don't forget, the rest of the story is coming up. We'll have more information about that at the end of the program today. But Ron, let's return to Tampa. You're in the locker room. You meet him. You get to see his ring size. But there's still a match. He still has to wrestle that night.
Yeah, you know, and in a lot of cases back in those days, the Battle Royal was at the end of the night, but most of the contestants in the Battle Royal had already wrestled in an earlier match. So you went out and you wrestled, and then but Andre didn't go. He doesn't have a single match. He's not involved in anything other than the Battle Royal. The Battle Royal is built for Andre. There was an event. They'd had Battle Royals before Andre came along, but Andre really made Battle Royals spectacular just because you had to have several people. If you're going to put Andre out of the ring, and I'd be darned, I was in a lot of Battle Royals with Andre, but I don't ever remember Andre being thrown out of the ring on a Battle Royal. And because of his immense size and his strength, and he's a scary individual. He was really a scary guy to think about wrestling him one on one. It takes a tremendous amount of guts to be able to make that happen. So we've wrestled, all of us on the card, once already, and then we go back in for the Battle Royal. I go to the ring early. Because I want to get the feel from the fans. You know, he's just rocked my world. I keep saying that, but he really did with his size and everything. And when he starts coming down that aisleway on his way to the ring in Tampa that night, it is extraordinary. I mean, the crowd, it's like it builds the enthusiasm and the awe and all of the whole thing that's happening to the crowd. It's happening in a movement of where he's at in the crowd. As he starts at the back starts to stand up, and there's a little roar. And the closer he gets to the ring, when they see him, when their eyes first see him, it's just the reaction is just phenomenal. It was wonderful for me standing in the middle of that ring. I didn't watch Andre come down the aisle. I watched the crowd because they just were just like I was when I first saw him coming through that door. They're just really, really into this guy. He is a spectacle among human beings that I don't know that there's ever been or ever will be another one like him. And he rocked their world in that Homer Hesterly Armory that night in Tampa. Everybody in that crowd, by the time he steps over that top rope, which was customary for him, and into that ring, there is every eye is on him, and there is nobody that isn't screaming something to their friends or to just to themselves that, wow, look at this guy.
On the topic of Battle Royals, Ron, I had an interesting conversation with Jim Cornette on one of his programs a little while back, where he discussed the different philosophies behind Battle Royals. There were territories like Los Angeles and San Francisco where the Battle Royal was an annual event. They did it one time and it was a big deal. They brought in attractions like Andre or Bruno Sammartino or whoever it may be. And it was a big event versus some territories did a Battle Royal on every show or just as an opening match thing or just to throw a bunch of guys out there for a second match. What was your philosophy about Battle Royals? How did you like to see a Battle Royal used by a promotion?
I always thought that a Battle Royal is something special. And if you anything you do in wrestling that you do too often, you take away that element. It's not special anymore after a while. I tried never to do Battle Royals unless I had that some spectacular element around. And Andre is a natural because it's hard to find a one individual that can compete with him. You can put him in handicap matches against two guys at once. It's a little bit better. But that battle royal just seems to be the ticket for it. And I used to, first time through, I always used him in battle royals. I used him in my cities most of the time, always in the battle royal, except there became times when we had great enough talent and we had people over enough that I would bring him in. I brought him in one time as my partner against Jerry Stubbs and Arn Anderson. When Jerry Stubbs was Mr. Olympia and Arn Anderson, and they were a fabulous team together. They were the champions, and it was a situation of where they had hurt my brother and they had hurt Jimmy. They had hurt everybody that I brought in, and I brought Andre as my partner. Obviously, we sold out everywhere we went with that. And in those situations, Andre was always great for that type of stuff. But battle royals, I just felt like you didn't do them very often. When you do them, you need to have a very good reason for them. Sometimes you do them on a holiday, Christmas night, Thanksgiving. I always love to run those holiday evenings and do something special. And you might throw a battle royal, but you got Andre. That's a special evening in itself, and it pretty much required, or it just was perfect to have the battle royal.
You know, one clip, since you mentioned Southeastern, him working for you there, from Knoxville, from the Knoxville end, there's one clip that I've seen so many times, and it lives in infamy, which is Ron Garvin versus Andre in Knoxville, where Andre takes more of a beating than any other match you'll see from that era. What do you remember about that?
I remember that Ronnie wanted to wrestle Andre. Andre wanted to do the match. Ronnie has that Canadian element. I think Ronnie is from Canada originally, and they got along great. Andre loved to work my territories. He loved to come and wrestle for me, for several reasons. I always had great guys that were happy, and dressing rooms were fun, and being around my crew was a great experience for wrestlers. And Andre didn't see a lot of that. He would tell me that later on in the 80s. He would say, "Ron, I love working for you. You've got your boys are so happy." So, and he and Ronnie got their heads together, and Ronnie says, "I want to work a single with Andre." And I was like, "Oh, geez, Ronnie, and then Andre, he had Andre call me and say, "Ron, I want to work with Ronnie Garvin." So I put him on a card. And like you said, I'll be darned, I watched that match live when it happened, and I was like, wow. I mean, yeah. It was a tremendous, tremendous wrestling match. It was fabulous, some of the stuff they did. And, you never know in wrestling what you're going to get. You have a good idea when you book the card, and you kind of know what guys are capable of. But in that example, I thought, this match may stink. And when I went out and watched it, I was like, so glad that I let them do it. Because it really, really was a rockin'. It was a great, great wrestling match, and it was great for both of them. And I think they really enjoyed it. I think they loved that match, as a matter of fact.
Andre's used to going territory to territory and winning battle royals. When he shows up to work for you, is it as simple as you just say, "There's a battle royal tonight, you're going over," or do you have to tell him anything? Or what do you tell any of the boys about going into that battle royal?
Really, you don't tell them. You don't really have to tell them anything. I mean, they pretty well know when they see Andre in the building and it's a battle royal that, Andre's going to win the battle royal. We like to figure things in our matches. We didn't just want to send a bunch of guys out there and have things happen haphazardly, or maybe not happen. In the worst case scenario, it just doesn't happen. It's not a good battle royal, and it's not exciting. And so we would engineer some things to take place during the battle royal that's going to build toward a climax, to the final part of it. And I don't know if everybody did that in every territory, but we always We wanted every match on the card from the beginning to the very last match to just be through the roof exciting for the fans. The fans would just go home going, I loved all of them. I loved every single match. And if you do that every night, you're going to build your territory. You're going to have a great business. It takes a little more time and a little more effort and a little more thought, but it's certainly well worth it in the long run.
Well, speaking of battle royals, let's head back to Tampa in 1974 for this battle royal.
Yes. And so we get the battle royal and the bell rings. And I remember that Andre's in the middle of the ring and everybody's working around him and no one's going to Andre. And I'm like, I'm one of them at the beginning of this. I'm like, well, I'm going to let somebody else make the first move on this guy. You know, I want to see what he's going to do and that type of thing. But I think we go, it seems like to me that the battle royal may go 4 or 5 minutes and Andre's really not in it. He's not involved in it. And when we met in the dressing room, he pantomimed to Frank about my height. You know, he was like, when I introduced myself to him, he looks at Frank and he goes, puts his hand over his head like, whoa, he's tall guy, you know? So I figured, you know, after 4 or 5 minutes and nobody seeming to go after Andre, well, here I went after Andre, you know, and it was by myself. And nobody else jumped into the fray. And the first, he just basically takes me up and does a press slam. He just raises me over his head as high as he can stretch his arms. And he walks to the edge of the ring and he bends his body sideways and he sets me down on my feet on the floor. It's like, you know, so I'm like, it's kind of an embarrassing thing in a way, you know. It's like, geez, man, he didn't have to do anything to get me out of there. And then to make matters even worse, he sets me on my feet and then he reaches down with his hands and he pats me on the ass. And he probably doesn't know very much English at all. And he goes, go, Ron. He remembered my name. Go, Ron. He points to the dressing room. Go, Ron. Okay. All right. I guess I will. You know, I mean, it's like, wow. It was very simple, very easy. I wasn't in the battle royal very long, obviously. And as time goes by, Andre and I just, we created such a phenomenal relationship with each other that we travel together. Every time he comes into my territory, he wants to go with me. And he would tell me, he would call and say, Ron, you pick me up? And I say, yeah, of course I'll pick you up. I travel with you? Yeah. Every night? Yeah. You know, I was like, oh, okay, Ron, good, good. You know, so he was just... We had a great relationship, and I always had fun with him. Andre could be a fun guy, especially when he, after the matches, and he gets to drinking a little bit. And that happened after just about every match. Ron, Andre loved his party. He enjoyed that. I think he lived for it, as a matter of fact, because his lifestyle was sad. It was extremely sad to be the size he was and to never be able to be anything other than everybody's focal point. And it's just a really difficult life. Hotels night after night. And as you said, he probably had a more demanding schedule than the world champions did. Vince run him everywhere. And it was always a good time when Andre showed up. Everybody's spirits were better in the dressing room than ever. It was like a party going on sometimes in the dressing room because Andre was right in the middle of it. He was really enjoying himself. The atmosphere was really good for him.
We have some listener questions here, Ron, that were originally sent in when you did the Super Studcast about Andre. These were originally for the rest of the Andre story, but they never got on air, so we're going to do them right now. But I want to ask you a question. As a promoter, who was more valuable to you when you had them for a week, Andre the Giant or the NWA World Champion?
Boy, that's a toss-up. to be quite honest with you, it's pretty much a toss-up. Andre, now, as time goes by with Andre, and like with anyone else, he's not highly involved. The world champion is a different commodity. When the world champion comes to town, you put him with your best baby face, usually, and you're going to have a great match. Sometimes Andre's battle royals do not build him as having great ability. But he didn't have to have great ability. His persona was so huge that it was enough. So I could never really tell a big difference in the crowd that you was drawn between the champion and with Andre. Andre was like a second world champion that came to your town, and you know you're going to have a big crowd because Andre's on that card, just like you always did when your world champion was on it.
When you bring in Andre, everyone who brought him in obviously as a babyface. He would either help out the other babyfaces or be the big babyface attraction in a battle royal. I don't think Vince McMahon Sr. would have allowed him to be used as a heel, but do you think he would have been effective if you had used him as a recurring heel character you could bring in versus how you did use him, how everyone used him, which was as a babyface who would come in at various times throughout the year?
Well, you know, I guess kind of the answer to that question is what developed in WrestleMania 3. I mean, you know, Andre, for the first time ever for anybody, was a heel. And, you know, he's got Bobby Heenan. Heenan's doing his deal for him. And, it was probably one of the best things they ever did at WWE back in those days, or WWF might have been in those days. I don't know when they switched the name exactly. But, you know, obviously that drew fabulous money. It drew a record, huge, huge crowd. And it got over. It really got over. And, Andre's just, there's so much to Andre. When you travel with Andre and when you deal with Andre and you see him deal with people in airports, and I've made a lot of trips with Andre. I've flown on planes with Andre. I have had so many things happen. I've been around Andre in almost every type of situation. And he was a very intricate person. He really had a lot of different things about Andre. He was much more than just a huge guy. He had a lot of elements about him. He loved to talk about his farms and things that you wouldn't expect from Andre. You would not expect. He is a much more complicated and intelligent individual than most people probably would have thought he would have been.
Well, let's get our first question in here, Ron. And this one was sent in by John Thompson in Bangor, Maine. Did you ever see Andre have a problem with a wrestler or anyone else?
Oh, good question. Top of my head, it comes to me in Knoxville. Might have been the first or second time he ever came to Knoxville. Probably 75, might have been 76. And we go out to a club there, and it was called the Intersection. There's a little club in Knoxville, and the wrestlers just kind of congregated there. Fans would go there after the matches. That place was on Friday nights after wrestling was a there wasn't a club in Tennessee that had more people in it than that one, because they knew they were going to have opportunity to see wrestlers. And that night the Giant comes. We actually partied with him when we're sitting and drinking with Andre. And as customary, you know, he comes in, and I had to find this out later on, but he buys the beer for everybody. And so later on, on another occasion, we put the beers on a table, an empty table, and count his beers at the end of the night. This is a different party, but this night there's a bunch of people around, and some guy comes and joins the party, kinds of squeezes his way into the table there, and There's several wrestlers around the table. There must be eight of us around one table. Andre's at that table, and we're drinking and we're laughing and talking, and this guy kind of infiltrates himself into the party. And I think he's with somebody else. They think he's with me or whatever. And so at the end of the party, the guy gets up to leave. And Andre says to me, he goes, Ron, he goes, do you know that guy? And I said, no. I thought maybe, you know, Ronnie knew him or so-and-so knew him or whoever's at the table, you know. And he goes, he's been drinking the beer. Andre's buying beer for everybody. He buys one can for you, and he buys six for him at the same time. So the waitress knows she brings one can for everybody and six for Andre. So this guy's been drinking the beer. So, you know, so the guy's starting to leave. And he gets up and he starts to walk away. Andre asked me real quick, and Andre stands up and he goes, "Hey, you." And the guy stops. Now, guy don't even turn around and look. He's like, "Oh, geez, man." And, you know, like, he surely ain't talking to me, you know. And he goes, "You." He said, "Come back over here." So the guy goes back, and Andre says to him, now the guy's standing close to him, and he's looking up at him. I mean, he's got a crick in his neck. He's looking straight up like he's looking up the top of a mountain. And Andre goes, "You pay for beer." And the guy goes, "Oh, yes, I'll pay for the beer. And he goes, "Yes, you will." And he took his hand, and he reached down over his shoulder to his wallet. He reached down and got his wallet out of his pants. The guy just stood there, man, like, "Oh, gosh, man, just please don't do something physically to me." And he reaches down. He pulls his wallet out of his pants. He opens his wallet, and he takes out all his cash. I don't know how much it was. He didn't count it or anything like that. And he looks the guy in the face again, and he goes, "You pay for your beer." And the guy's shaking his head now. Yes, please, just leave it at that. And Andre then takes his wallet. He reaches over his shoulder again. He just stuffs it down into his pocket, and he kind of like he did to me in the Battle Royal, he points at the door, and he says, "You go now." And the guy, boy, I mean, he was gone in a split second. But that's probably as bad a problem as I ever saw anybody have with Andre. I can't imagine anybody being foolish enough to want to have a problem with a guy's Andre's size. You'd have to be something wrong with you mentally to think that you'd have any chance against a guy like that.
You mentioned his farm before, and on that topic, our next question's from Bob Davis in Seattle, Washington. "I heard somewhere that Andre had a farm in North Carolina. Do you know where? And did you ever visit?"
Yes, I know where. Andre and I talked about it many, many times. Lots of times on trips, he would get sentimental. He would have himself a few beers, a few 100 beers. You know, he gets pretty sentimental. I saw him drink 5 gallons of wine one night. He got sentimental, and he wanted to talk about his home and how much he loved his farm. And his farm was in a little town in North Carolina called Ellerby. It must have been a tiny little town. I don't know what the population of Ellerby was, but I had the feeling from Andre that, you know, there's nothing there but farms. And Andre loved his farm. He talked about it so many times to me. And he talked about Frenchie. Frenchie Bernard was a great friend of Andre's. Andre really trusted him and had a lot of respect for him. And Frenchie would run his farm. Andre was on the road all the time. He didn't get to go home. And I think that made his farm that much more important to him. It was that sanctuary away from the road, and that peace of mind, and the quiet, and people not coming up to him and trying to introduce themselves or bothering him, or, you know, it was his getaway. that farm of his was his getaway. And I could tell that when I talked to him that he really just loved it. He not only loved it, he needed it. It was a great thing that he had a place like that that was not in a city and not around a lot of people. Probably didn't have any visitors, very few that came. I know wrestlers came there, and I wanted to go there on many occasions. I kept saying, Andre, I want to come and see you. Yes, Ron. Yes, I want you to come. You know, he would show me pictures. He showed me a picture of his horse one time. He says, Ron, you're the stud. He goes, look at my horse. And I look at this horse, and I'm like, oh, my God, Andre, the horse has got a suede back. It looks almost like a cartoon, right? You know, and I said, Andre, did you do that to his back? Oh, he's a good horse, Ron. And I go, yeah, but look at his back, man. You know, you must, how many, do you ride him fast? Well, he can't run too good, Ron. And I'm thinking, well, of course he can't run too good. He's got 500 plus pounds on him, you know. So he just really loved his farm. And he was such a remarkable person to be around. It just anybody, I don't think I ever saw anybody around Andre that didn't have a smile on their face. That kind of goes back to that other question that the one before had about having a problem with him. People did not think negative feelings. They had no negative thoughts or feelings when they were around Andre. They were just so awestruck by it that they would have these funny looking faces, you know, like you couldn't tell what they're thinking, but you know, it was a wonderful guy, wonderful human being to be around. I was so blessed to have the opportunity not to just be around him, but to be a friend of his and to have him want to travel with me and got a lot of great stories about that. And we're going to get to other episodes later on in the chronology here as we move forward, where I'll be able to tell more stories about traveling with him and the time I spent with him.
One final question here this week, Ron, and this one is from Shana Robinson in Houston, Texas. What kind of money did Andre make in the early 1970s?
Jeez. You know, I asked him one time this question, and this was probably in 76. 77, when he was starting to come to Knoxville, and he wanted to come a lot. He would ask Vince to, you know, book me in Knoxville in Tennessee, Ron Fuller's territory, you know. So I end up getting Andre quite a bit, which was really nice. I always loved it, and I always did well. I mean, business is going to be good if Andre's in town. And I asked Andre probably in 1976, we're flying somewhere, and we got to talking money. And I said, you know, Andre, you know, how much money do you make a year? You know, I know you're going everywhere and you're getting paid, and, you know, I take care of Vince, and, you know, and I do what I'm supposed to do so far as taking care of your pay. And, you know, I was curious, just like this fan here, this lady from Houston, is how much he made. And he told me, this was probably 1976, he said, Ron, in the early 70s, I make $400,000 a year. I was like, wow, my goodness gracious, man. You know, I mean, I know he's going everywhere for it. I mean, literally all over the world. He went all over the world for it. But, you know, and I assumed he's probably talking about 73, 74. In this time frame that we're talking about this meeting him, he's making $400,000 a year. That, you know, put him back in those days, he's probably one of the highest paid athletes that are going. You know, he's doing some big business there.
With that, we will wrap up another episode of the Studcast. A few reminders here at the end of the program, of course. You can friend the stud on Facebook, the page Ron Fuller, the Tennessee Stud. You can follow the stud on Instagram and Twitter at Ron Fuller Welch. You can follow me on Twitter at Great Brian Last, and you can hear me each week on the 605 Super Podcast.
at 605pod.com or available wherever you find your favorite podcasts. Also, don't forget to visit tnstud.com to get both weekly and super studcasts. And of course, you can leave your fan reviews. You can shop the stud store for souvenirs and read about the history of the Tennessee stud. Of course, you can get your super studcast there as well as patreon.com/studcast. And don't forget, the rest of the story, Japan 1983, debuts Tuesday, the 26th of June. Once again, tnstud.com or patreon.com/studcast. Ron, where are we headed next week?
Well, next week, we're going to go back into the Florida history, into the chronology in Florida. We're in 71. We're going to talk more about West Palm. I've just become the local promoter, basically, for West Palm Beach. And we've got that thing going. We're really rocking business there. We're going to talk about what's happening in Florida at that point. They're adding great new talent. A lot of big name stars are involved and going to be coming to Florida. We're going to talk about a subject that fans probably know very little about, and that is cauliflower ears. We're going to talk about my getting a cauliflower ear, and my dad couldn't have been happier. My granddad couldn't have been happier. I mean, it's the symbol of a wrestler or a boxer, and my granddad had two of them. One wasn't enough. He had two of them, and he looked like a taxi cab driving down the street with both back doors open. They were big boys. So, and how painful cauliflower ears are. I think fans will find that pretty intriguing that a small thing like your ear can cause such pain for you.
Unless you have cauliflower ears, you can hear us next week right here on the Studcast. Of course, Ron Fuller's Studcast is a production of the Arcadian Vanguard Podcast Network. For the Tennessee Stud, Ron Fuller, I'm the great Brian Last. The story continues next week.
Thanks for joining us today for this historic Studcast. The true story continues next week. So fool Nelson your friends and point them in our direction for another ride with the Tennessee Stud.
One, two, three.
This is David Summers saying so long from the Great Smoky Mountains.